Your conference is being recorded.
This is Janet DeGeorge. Oh, go ahead, Harold. Sorry.
No, that's okay. This is Harold Johnson. I'm the co-director of the Algorithm Project, along with Janet DeGeorge and a team of critical individuals who work with us consistently in this project. I have the pleasure today to introduce you Dr. Catherine Corr. Dr. Corr has a rich and varied background that's going to serve us very well today. She has not only been a teacher of infants and toddlers, but also an early intervention professional. She received her doctorate in 2015 from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and is a Doris Duke Fellow. She now works as a research associate in the Department of Special Education at Vanderbilt University, with research focused upon the well-being of infants and toddlers with disabilities and their families who are experiencing poverty, toxic stress, and trauma. This summer, I'm very pleased to tell you that she has accepted a tenure-track position at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in Special Education Department. In addition, she is in a leadership position within the Division of Early Childhood for Special Education, where she is one of the leaders for a new SIG that had just been created entitled Protecting and Well-Being Special Interest Group. In addition, she is a member of the Interdivisional Caucus of CEC's Maltreatment Prevention Work Group. Today's presentation is entitled They Won't Remember, Myths About Child Abuse, Neglect, and Very Young Children. The focus is to help us all better understand the incidents, indicators, response, and impact of child maltreatment as experienced by children with disabilities. The Division of Early Childhood's position statement regarding child abuse, neglect, and trauma, and particularly how families can be supported in establishing safe and supportive environments from birth to three. Today's presentation from Dr. Corr is a remarkable match with the Hands of Voices vision statement, which is that we envision a world where children who are deaf and hard of hearing will have every opportunity to achieve their full potential. That potential cannot be experienced if children are experiencing maltreatment. And today's presentation from Dr. Corr is an important step to help us to be better informed and better prepared to prevent, as well as then to recognize and respond to maltreatment of our students. Dr. Corr, thank you for being with us today, and I'll turn over the presentation to you.
Great. Thank you, Harold. Thank you, Janet. I'm very happy to be here. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and as Harold mentioned, I'm a former early intervention provider and preschool teacher, and this is sort of where this topic really arose to my interest and where I really felt like I needed to go back to start to think about how we can better support families who are experiencing some of these complex situations. I have prepared a little bit to chat about today in terms of thinking about myths. I'm going to talk through three common myths that I hear when I work with early childhood teachers, and even when I work with other professionals who work with children with disabilities and individuals with disabilities. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my line of research and sort of how that ties into how we better support these families. And then I'm going to share with you about the DEC position statement on child maltreatment and abuse. And then I would love to answer questions and sort of hear some responses from all of you. I'm a fairly interactive presenter, so this is going to be a little bit tricky for me, but I'm going to do my best to sort of give you some good content and then leave lots of time for some questions and some back and forth. So I'm going to go ahead and get started with three common myths about child abuse and neglect. The first I'm going to talk about is the connection between age and maltreatment. And from the title of the presentation, you might kind of guess what this is. Oftentimes we hear when working with young children that if they've experienced abuse and neglect, it may not really matter because they won't remember it. So as an infant or a toddler, they may not have the words to tell you later on the line what happened to them. And I'm here to tell you today that is absolutely false. It is an incredibly important period of time and critical not only of brain development, but also social emotional development. And I also want to kind of think about the connection between age and maltreatment. So when I talk with folks, they often think that children maybe between the ages of 5 and 10 are the most frequent victims of abuse and neglect. And I'm actually here to tell you today that the most vulnerable population, so the most frequent victims of child abuse and neglect, are children birth to three. And when we think about that, those are very young children who oftentimes don't have words yet to tell us what is going on. So we have to be extra sensitive to what's going on in their world, and as well as being sensitive to what's going on with their caregivers. So that's myth number one, that young children don't experience abuse, and even if they do, they won't remember it. The second piece that I'd like to talk a little bit about is the perpetrators of abuse. So oftentimes when we think about really young children, folks don't really think about who the perpetrators of abuse are. And actually, in all cases of abuse and neglect, the perpetrator is typically someone that the child knows. So whether that be a parent, whether it be a teacher, whether it be a teacher's aide, whether it be someone on a bus, it is typically someone that the child is familiar with. So that's not to scare you or to put you on high alert, but it does change our perspective in terms of how we think about partnering with families and how we think about supporting families as well as protecting children. The third myth that I'm going to talk a little bit about is the connection between disability and maltreatment. So I'm going to share some stat with you that I think oftentimes kind of opens people's eyes to this topic a little bit. So if an individual has a disability at any point across the lifespan, they're at a higher likelihood of experiencing abuse, neglect, or maltreatment. And if you've experienced abuse and neglect or maltreatment across the lifespan, you're at a higher likelihood of developing a disability. So there's this relationship between disability and abuse that we can't really ignore. But at the same time, at least for those of us in special education, we haven't necessarily always paid attention to. So there's a strong relationship. And in my perspective as an early childhood professional, since there's this strong connection, their young children are the most frequent victims of maltreatment, and perpetrators tend to be people that the child knows, there seems to be this natural point in time where we can intervene and prevent child abuse and neglect. So that sort of leads me to telling you a little bit about my work and how this ties into early childhood in general, and sort of spans special education as well. So my work really focuses on three different pillars. The first is thinking about how do we create high-quality early childhood environments for young children with disabilities who've experienced abuse. And that means how do we set children up for success in preschool or childcare or home visiting scenarios? And in order to do that, we have to think about practice. So what are evidence-based practices to do that? The second pillar is preparation. So if we know what the evidence-based practices are to support these families, how do we support professionals to do this really tough work? And so that means thinking about pre-service opportunities as well as in-service opportunities for early childhood professionals. And that can be anyone from a home visitor to a childcare worker to a kindergarten teacher. It's really a broad span of folks. And then third is thinking about systems responsibilities. So how do we create robust systems of support for not only families, but also for the professionals who work in them? So when we talk about young children with disabilities who have experienced abuse, they're often being served or supported by multiple systems, whether that's special education and child welfare, whether it's regular education, special education and child welfare. So there are a lot of different systems at play. And when we think about supporting both professionals and families, we have to think about how those systems play together. I'm going to give you an example from each of these, from each of these pillars that sort of highlight how this actually looks in day-to-day early childhood, in the day-to-day early childhood world. So I'm going to start with an example from practice, and this is a real-life example. I was supervising student teachers who were sort of in the first 5 weeks of doing student teaching in preschool classrooms, and I had a student teacher come to me and say she was working with three-year-olds and she just had this one three-year-old that was really, really needy. And so I asked her to sort of reflect and think about what was going on with that child. And as she started to reflect, she told me more about the fact that this child would come in and need to sit on her lap. She wouldn't sit and do her work independently. She didn't want to socialize with other kids in the classroom. In many ways, she was, as the student teacher described, just very needy. She sort of explained this in the context that her and her cooperating teacher decided to have sort of an intervention where they would, if the child came to try and sit on their lap, that they would remove her from their lap and kind of put her into an independent work area. And part of the reason I'm telling you this is because when we think about some of the best practices that we might use in early childhood classrooms, they don't necessarily consider if trauma or abuse or neglect have taken place. So in this particular instance, this young child had a parent who was involved in domestic violence with her mother, and her father was taken to jail. So part of this scenario makes us think about how we are supporting young kids in the classroom. So if our first thought was to remove the child from an activity or take her out of a teacher's lap in terms of thinking about how to get her to engage in the classroom, that could very well be traumatizing for her. So when we think about early childhood practices and when we think about how we're preparing early childhood professionals to create supportive and responsive environments, it's really important to think about what best practices look like, especially for this population. In terms of preparation, we prepare early childhood, and I think we prepare special educators to be really good observers of behavior. So thinking about how to influence behavior, how to support behavior, and we really pride ourselves on teaching children pro-social behaviors. And so I'm going to share with you an example of how in early childhood we prepare folks, but it might not necessarily take into account a maltreatment or trauma perspective. So this, again, is another real-life scenario where we had a student teacher in a classroom who was working with kids who were preschool age, so right around three. They were doing some dramatic play. So in the dress-up area, they were playing. They had all kinds of doctor's equipment. And there was one child who regularly had some challenging behavior or alarming behavior, as the student teacher put it. So there was this three-year-old young girl who would sort of act out these really traumatic experiences. So she would she would take a knife from the dramatic play area and pretend to slit her throat and say things like, "I'm going to hurt you," or "I'm going to hurt." She would insert a child's name. And the teacher's response was to kind of intervene and really rework that behavior. So she would say things like, "Knives aren't for hurting, knives are for cutting food, knives are for," and give her examples of how knives can really be used in a preschool classroom. However, no one really addressed the trauma or the abuse situation that was going on. So for that child, when she was acting out in dramatic play, there wasn't really a social support there for her or an emotional support to work through some of that. Another example is sometimes they would engage in dramatic play around that instance. So a teacher's aide would say, "Oh, she's cut herself. Why don't we call the ambulance?" So in some ways, we would think, you know, we like to build off of the child's experience and sort of support their imaginative behavior. In other ways, I would say it's a little alarming because we want to support this child's social-emotional development, and this seems like a child who's particularly dealing with some trauma and abuse that needs to be directly addressed. finally, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some cross-systems issues that come up when we are supporting young children with disabilities who've experienced abuse. So oftentimes, these young kiddos are served by multiple systems, as I've told you. And oftentimes, there's some competing priorities in the different systems. So I'll give you an example. If a child who's experienced abuse and neglect is on a return home path, meaning a parent is trying to regain custody of that child, oftentimes that parent's required to sort of prove that they are responsible enough to have their child back in custody. And in order to do that, they complete courses. So they'll complete child development courses, they'll complete anger management courses. That really depends upon the court system and the individual family's situation. The trick is that oftentimes these families are completing these courses that may not necessarily meet their needs. So for young kids with disabilities, this is particularly important because if there's a child who has a disability, a parent will be attending a child development class. But that child development class is really all about typical development. And so technically this parent is attending that class to sort of give the stamp of approval that they're ready to take on the responsibility of supporting their child. And in reality, that class didn't necessarily have the content that they needed to be successful supporting their child with a disability. So when we think about sort of these gaps across practice, preparation, and cross systems, there are lots of good things happening. So we have a huge focus on social emotional development in early childhood right now, which is great. But we're missing the piece on child maltreatment, and we're missing the piece on trauma. So there's lots of places where we need to fill in the gaps. And that brings me to talking about the DEC position statement on child maltreatment. So we recognize that this was an area that was really untapped and that needed some attention and focus. We also recognize that different organizations or different disciplines sort of took responsibility for different pieces. So in child welfare, they would say, I know a lot about child abuse and neglect. We cover that, but I don't cover disability. And in our special education community, we heard a lot of folks saying, I know I'm a mandated reporter, but outside of that, I don't know what to do with a child who's experienced abuse and neglect. So I focus on the disability piece. And we're arguing that by focusing just on those pieces and not focusing on the whole child and the family, oftentimes supports are fragmented. So we decided to write a position statement on this to really, one, raise awareness, and two, make some improvement on some long and short-term goals. So the DEC position statement, which I think was shared with you, was written over the course of a year with a group of folks who were practitioners, researchers, as well as policymakers. And our goal was to focus on how can we as an organization think both in terms of prevention and intervention in terms of child maltreatment for young children with disabilities. By doing that, we decided that we really didn't want this to be just a piece of paper that lived on the internet somewhere. We wanted it to be a reason to take action. So we wrote long and short-term goals for the position statement. In doing so, we started to think about, well, who is really responsible for these long and short-term goals? And so because we wrote these goals, we created a special interest group, which Harold had mentioned earlier in the call, which is the DEC Protection and Wellbeing Special Interest Group. And this group is made up of individuals who just have an interest in child abuse and neglect and promoting child well-being. And this group focuses on how do we improve practice, how do we improve personal preparation, how do we improve research, how do we improve policy, and how do we improve collaboration in terms of thinking about young children with disabilities who've experienced abuse. So I'll give you a quick example of some things that the group is currently working on. In terms of practice, we are currently taking the DEC recommended practices and doing a crosswalk to look at trauma-informed practices to see which of our DEC recommended practices could qualify as trauma-informed or how we could enhance the DEC recommended practices by adding trauma-informed practices. And our goal there is to really get the field to think about if we have these solid foundational practices, how do we make them more inclusive of families who are experiencing more complex scenarios? In terms of personal preparation, we're thinking a lot about pre and in-service opportunities for folks. We are thinking both long and short term about how do we enhance personal preparation opportunities that already exist. So we're pushing people to think about how do you incorporate this information into families classes, into child development classes, rather than having a standalone class on child abuse and neglect. In terms of research, we are one of the tricks about research with this population is that they're a vulnerable population. And so if you're a researcher, sometimes that takes a longer amount of time and a lot more energy to do a research study specifically with this population. However, we think it's really important. And so our research arm is writing recommendations for researchers in terms of how do you ethically and responsibly engage a population like this in research. So we can push the field to do rigorous research around this population so we have an evidence base to work from. And then in terms of policy, we've been doing a lot of work around highlighting states who are having successes in terms of thinking about how systems work together. So we've talked a lot with Alaska and Colorado. There are two states that have done really exciting things in terms of sort of systematizing the approach to families who are in multiple systems. And so our policy group is sort of having, we want to highlight successes from the field to show folks that while this topic can be overwhelming, that there are folks who have had successes and that we can build from those instead of reinventing the wheel. And then finally, in terms of collaboration, we really see this effort as multidisciplinary. And while we're engaging the DEC community, we recognize that there are other organizations that really need to be a part of this. And so we've reached out to other organizations in terms of thinking about endorsements and thinking about ways that the DEC and CEC community can collaborate to think about this population more proactively.
Excuse me, Dr. Kaur. If you are on the line, could you please mute your phone? Make sure your phone is muted. There's quite a bit of background noise. Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Kaur. Sorry.
No problem. That is actually a perfect stopping point. So I've given you a lot of information. We've talked a little bit about three myths that are perpetuated, not just in early childhood, but I think in education as well. We talked a little bit about how what this work really looks like in the early childhood population. And then we've talked a little bit about the position statement as well as the new special interest group that is taking on some of this work. So I would love to open it up for questions or comments or discussions to see if I can answer or expand on anything that relates to what you all are doing.
Dr. Kaur, this is Harold, Harold Dunston. One of your handouts, you also share information about the protective factors that the Child Welfare Information Network has identified. And those factors, I think, would be particularly interesting to our members who are part of the Guide by Your Side program, which are experienced parents of kids deaf and hard of hearing who have received additional training to go in and work with early intervention specialists as parents are first being identified as having a child deaf and hard of hearing. And in working with those guides, and some remarkable individuals they are, and, you know, they, Hands of Voices has been involved with this topic of child maltreatment for at least 10-plus years. So a lot of information has been shared, but there's still concern, certainly, on the part of a lot of people, certainly Guide by Your Side, that they don't want to do anything that would alienate the parents or make the parents feel uncomfortable or not want to be involved mm-hmm. with early intervention or guy by our sides. And so that if you will, that pressure between recognizing and maybe and supporting families maybe that are in some degree of stress as opposed to simply accepting and welcoming parents regardless of where they are. Can you talk about maybe that kind of tension and the occurred not only for our guy by our sides but also early intervention specialists, but particularly these protective factors?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Harold. And you're right, there is a tension sort of in the field just in terms of how do we go about supporting families without alienating them or stigmatizing them. And I'm going to, in order to think about this, I'm going to have you think about families in general who have young children with disabilities. So if you think back to that stat that I shared with you, that if you have a disability, you're at an increased likelihood for experiencing abuse or neglect or maltreatment. When I think about that, I think about one of our roles in early intervention is to really build the protective factors of young children and their families. So we're not in, we're doing work not only with children in isolation, but with their families. And it's part of our role and responsibility to really think about how we build those nurturing relationships and attachments, how we think about building parent resilience, how we think about connecting that parent to other resources if they need it. And so I would actually recommend that we think about building protective factors across all families in early intervention. And then I think specifically when there's been child abuse and neglect that's taken place, it gets more complex. So whether or not that parent is going to regain custody of that child or if there is a foster parent involved, that will sort of change your approach. But I think building protective factors are something that we should be doing for all families. And it seems like a great way for professionals to really reach out and say, you know, this is information that's relevant to all parents. I think oftentimes we have, I think in our attempts to focus on certain families, we tend to stigmatize them, which is difficult. And while we want to have targeted supports, we really want to be sure that we aren't stigmatizing certain families over others.
Thank you. I think one of the things that this is Harold Johnson again. One of the things I think the Hands and Voices does particularly well is this whole idea of establishing social connections, which is one of those factors that you mentioned. Mm. And the extent to which, you know, parents have more than just the immediate people around them that they can ask questions of and see how things
right.
are done or not done. So just making the connections, having someone being present, someone who is a good listener as well as an observant to know maybe when a family is in trouble and might need some additional assistance and then who to contact. But are you saying too, though, that the most of the early intervention professionals, while they know, if you will, that the occurrence and the indicators, are they also well prepared as to what to do in response to a kid who has or a family that's experienced this trauma?
Well, so I would say that early intervention providers are really skilled and focused on strengths-based, family-centered practices, which I think are really important. And I think when children are involved in abuse and neglect scenarios, that becomes harder. And oftentimes what we hear from early intervention professionals is that they don't know how to do strengths-based, family-centered approaches with families who have been involved in abuse and neglect scenarios. Not that they don't apply, they just don't know how it would work. And so I think that comes back to Harold thinking about, well, if we recognize our role is really building protective factors for families and it is your job and responsibility to think about how you're building that nurturing relationship and building that healthy attachment between the parent and the child, that sort of will change how you work with that family versus saying, oh, these aren't the families that I know how to work with. And so we've been pushing the field on that a little bit. And I think we have a little ways to go in terms of being completely prepared and ready to support families who've experienced abuse and neglect and maltreatment.
Thank you. I'm aware that we have a rich and diverse group of people on this phone calls with very different contexts that you're experiencing and calling from. Are there other questions that the participants would like to ask Dr. Kaur?
My name is Chuck Ludwig. as you're talking about families and our preparedness to deal with those families, I think I think we have to also take a look at the fact that many of these families, that is the parents, also have experienced the kind of traumas that we're talking about. So I think that has to be factored into as we're looking at preventative approaches with the families.
Yeah, absolutely, Chuck. And I think that's what we hear from folks in terms of what trips them up when they're trying to do strength-based approaches is that they'll say, well, this mother has serious mental health issues, and I'm not really sure where to begin. And so what we are trying to challenge people to start thinking about is that your role as an early intervention provider is not just working with the child. It is really working with the parent and the child. And how do you build that relationship when there has been sort of multi-generational maltreatment or abuse or even neglect?
This is Chuck again. I understand that there's things out in Walla Walla, Washington, where they've incorporated some of this in terms of, you know, looking at not just the behavior, but the whys of that behavior. I'm not sure if that's a model that people are looking at also.
Thank you, Chuck.
Yeah, thanks.
Go ahead.
This is Janet DeGeorge from Hands and Voices. I have a question. The scenario you gave earlier of a preschool teacher in a classroom with a student who's acting out with a knife, in a perfect world, if the teacher had been trained appropriately and the school had a system in place, could you walk us through a little bit about what would it look like in a really good situation when someone encounters something like that? What would they be doing? Who would they be talking to?
Yeah.
Who would they be calling? That kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a great question. So in that scenario, what we would really want to happen, and I do want to say that this isn't only the early childhood preschool teacher's responsibility, but what we would really want happening is that classroom teacher talking with a school social worker and really talking through what's happening with that child. And when talking with the school social worker, they might make a plan for play, free play. They might have the child herself may have special sessions with the social worker. But what we would like to see in the early childhood classroom is have the teacher be more aware of those are red flags and signs that this child needs more social emotional support. So for instance, instead of necessarily building that into dramatic play, there might be an opportunity for the teacher to talk one-on-one with that child so that child could still get that those feelings out to the teacher, but without it turning into sort of a classroom routine where other children are building off of it. So there are lots of different opportunities in early childhood classrooms to talk about emotions, to read books about emotions, to really draw and think about your emotions. And what we don't want to see happen is that child be stifled and not be able to share those things in a safe place. But I do think in a perfect world, we would see more of a collaboration between the early childhood teacher and a social worker in the school, and then we would see some of that morph into what happens in the regular preschool classroom.
Mm-hmm. This is Janet, just a follow-up comment. I think that's great, and in the applicability in our world of parent-to-parent support, it's just a reminder that we're not alone. When we encounter something we're not sure of, that we have someone else that we can go talk to about it, like you said, the teacher talking to the social worker. And also, I think we in our community of learners, we talk a lot about 1-800-4-A-CHILD, which is a phone that you can call anonymous counselors who will talk you through any situation and give you advice. Because I think a lot of times it's not really black and white. We're not sure what to do. So I love your response that, you know, talk to somebody else about this and not just hold it yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Janet. Oftentimes, We hear from early childhood professionals that there are these soft signs of abuse. So they don't necessarily have physical markings, or it isn't very blatant behavior that's really triggering a response from a teacher, but it's sort of these things that are happening on a daily basis, whether it's uncontrolled crying at certain parts in the day, or children who are regressing in terms of potty training. And so there's sort of some of these soft signs that people really need help and assistance to walk through or talk through about what to do, how to make a plan or make a next step for.
Are there other questions? I've always got questions, guys. You know me, but I don't want to take all the time. Other questions that you guys would like to ask Dr. Kaur?
I've got one. This is Sarah Kennedy in Colorado. I'm the director of the chapter, and we have a parent guide system that meets with new families. So I wanted to ask about, sometimes we're referred to families by professionals who feel like there's some concern about parents adjusting to the child's hearing loss or other difficulties in new baby land, like feeding and the financial concerns of buying hearing aids or, you know, anything that might disrupt attachment. And I think we're kind of sent in with the idea that we could discern, you know, whether or not this mom or dad is really having difficulty. And I love what you said about we just want to build protective factors across all families. So we do the same regardless, you know, make sure they have social connections and more resources and ask questions. But I wonder if there are tools that lay people might be able to use just to help us think through all the areas we want to observe when we're at a home visit, especially when we're sent in with that caveat, you know, please check this family out.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think when, especially when doing home visits, because you are in the family's most natural environment, it becomes a lot trickier. And I think being a home visitor, you have to really understand how to observe well. And on top of that, how to sort of reflect what just happened after a visit. So I think in terms of thinking about some skills that home visitors should have, I would say being able to observe really well and then reflect on what happened is really important. In terms of tools for thinking about if families need more support, I can't think off the top of my head about kind of a toolbox or anything off the top of my head, but when I think of ways that I would look at a family and see if they need more support, I would probably spend a lot of time looking at that parent-child interaction, and looking at sort of attachment and sort of how their regular routine is looking. We hear a lot from early intervention providers about how they'll go into a home and a family may have dirty dishes everywhere and the kids are in dirty clothes, but the parents have a loving, responsive relationship with the child. So the early intervention provider is less concerned because there's an overall responsive relationship that's happening. So for me, I would really focus on that relationship. I think the hard part becomes when a child is in foster care. So building that relationship can be hard because it may not be the child's first foster home, and it could have been a traumatic experience for that child to leave their biological home. But I think that's the place that I would start to think about what's going on with a family and what kind of supports might they need on top of our regular supports.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Kaur, this is Harold again. A few things that Handsome Voices have developed over years. One, the series of documents called Silence is Not an Option. And those documents are geared towards the age of the kids. And they're both things to look for, but even more importantly, things to develop between families and children that keep kids safe and successful. We've also developed a safety checklist, which are a series of just real simple questions. And if the answer is no to any of those, then suggest some activities that may help to support families and their kids. But one particular effort, I wonder, Cressa Brinkman, I'm not sure if she's on the telephone call right now, but is leading an effort to identify children's literature books that parents can read to and with their children that just kind of reaffirm, you know, loving, supportive homes, the use of language, you know, to express feelings, and kind of what happens, you know, in homes, you know, where people care about each other. Are you aware of any other efforts that are using children's literature and parents reading to their kids as a way to both inform kids and also to reinforce the bond between parents and children?
That's a great question. You know, there's a lot of focus on shared story reading in early childhood, just thinking about overall promoting social emotional development, but not necessarily focused on kids who experience abuse or neglect. So there are efforts to sort of get parents, especially parents of children with disabilities, to think about how their child is sharing their emotions or displaying their emotions. But it doesn't necessarily take into account if there has been abuse or neglect. But I would be really interested to hear about the book sharing that you're talking about, Harold. That sounds really interesting.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me? This is Krista Brinkman. Can you hear me?
Perfect. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, good. Yes, I am on the call. And Harold, I was just getting ready to say something, so I'm so glad that you spoke up. This is Krista Brinkman from Colorado Hands and Voices. And I would love to connect with you. And one thing I was thinking about is in the back of one of the books we just did for our February book club, they had a really nice graph of how to identify concerning flags for sexual abuse, verbal abuse, and also, I can't remember if it was also neglect, but there were certain flags to watch for. And I really liked how they outlined it for the caregiver or the provider or the teacher or the parent who are reading that book to look at, to watch for those indications of abuse. And I feel like for a lot of people, it would be helpful to kind of clear up that ambiguity. And the knife story, I think, was a great example of, okay, is this somebody, you know, a child who just has a really creative imagination? Maybe they were helping their parent cut something one time and they cut themselves and realized what, you know, who knows, older siblings? Or is this actually a situation that really isn't typical? And so I always love that in the Our Children Project, we talk about, you know, it is obviously, and I think this is a universal message, it's not yours to discern whether or not it is an instance of abuse. If you have a concern that you feel that there might be abuse, yours is to, you can call 1-800-4-CHILD, and you need to report it, especially if you are told specifically about an abusive situation. But I really liked that just small, little, clean, crisp chart in the back of the book, and I thought, gosh, if nothing else, if that could just resonate with somebody who takes our sheet and looks at this book, that would be largely helpful for so many children.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. I would love to get a copy of that.
This is Krista. I will connect with you.
Good. I was just going to say, please do that. We're just about up on our time, but there is probably time for one last question. Someone on the phone call would care to ask. Dr. Kaur?
This is Chuck again. I you were talking about children in foster care, and I'm wondering if there is any policy or practice in terms of involving the parent of that child when that child is in foster care. I know there are times where the parent can't be because of the child is a threat, but I also know there's an emphasis of trying to have the parent participate. So I'm wondering if that's built into any policy, and should that be looked at in terms of trying to move ahead the relationship between parent and child?
Yeah, Chuck, you've hit on a big issue. So I'll give you some examples from early intervention, but it will vary a little state by state. But you're right; it sort of depends upon the family scenario. So if the parent is on track to regaining custody, in an ideal world, I would say from an early intervention standpoint, we would want sessions to be taking place not only with the foster parent, but also with the biological parent, because we'd want that biological parent to be involved. We'd want them to feel prepared for when that child transitions back into their care. However, right now, that doesn't take place, or it doesn't take place regularly. And part of it is because some systems barriers. So We hear a lot from early intervention providers around confusion around whether or not they can talk to the biological parent because they're concerned about HIPAA, and they're oftentimes not clued into what's going on with the child welfare case. So from in our perspective, when we think about setting parents up for success and creating smooth transitions, we think it's a no-brainer to have early intervention providers involved in sort of supporting that biological parent. However, right now, due to, I would say, some confusion between systems or across systems, that doesn't happen regularly. I've been working with a group in Illinois to start thinking about when biological parents are granted supervised visits, that those visits, if the child has a disability, that their early intervention provider could be there to sort of support those supervised visits. One, so they can kind of have a chance to see what the early intervention looks like and get familiar with that. But two, so that early intervention provider can really create a strong environment and a supportive environment so that parent and child can feel successful to start building that attachment again. But I think we're a long ways away from that happening regularly. But I do think you're right. There, in with children who are in child welfare, we're often trying to do this work with both the biological and foster parents. And sometimes we don't know where the child is going to end up. And sometimes the child will move between foster homes, so that will also make it complicated. Nevertheless, we still think that family-centered, strength-based approaches are applicable to these families. They'll just require a set of sort of sensitivity and flexibility in order to be able to do it well.
This is Cresta from Colorado again. And I also know of some situations where they'll do supervised visits and have the guardian ad litem there as well as the foster parent and sometimes even a physician. And in those opportunities, sometimes when it's instances of neglect, it becomes apparent in some of those supervised visits the things that the parents just aren't privy to in terms of basic safety. I can think of a specific example that had to do with the snacks that were brought and something that the child put in their mouth from the snacks, and the parent, biological parent, did not act in a way to protect the child, and so the guardian ad litem and the foster parent had to step in. And so at that point, it was something of them taking notes to say, okay, this is clearly something that they're unaware of. So they realized sometimes in that situation, it was just the fact that that parent wasn't privy to basic safety precautions for that child at that age.
Yeah, and I think that's a great example of a small scenario that can go a really long way. So if we're able to set up a supportive environment where we're able to share those safety strategies, we can build that parent's confidence and competence, and ultimately those supervised visits may become unsupervised, and that parent will be able to be more successful versus sort of just not doing that those types of activities and leaving the parent to figure it out on their own.
I'd like to thank Dr. Kaur for sharing her information with us today. I will tell you all that I consider Dr. Kaur to be one of the individuals that I'm looking forward to not only watching but working with and learning from, and I would suggest that she be identified as one of our bright spots for our community so that we can continue to follow her work during her course of her career. Also, would like to tell everyone that next month, Dr. Paula Crowley from the University of Illinois State University College of Education will be talking to us about preventing child abuse and neglect as it occurs with kids, school-age kids particularly. And this will follow along with her 2016 text that she just published entitled Preventing Abuse and Neglect in the Lives of Children with Disabilities. I would ask that everyone on this call please consider suggesting to Janet DeGeorge and myself, Harold Johnson, other individuals, other bright spots, people that we can not only learn from but also hopefully recognize and support in some way in their work to help keep our kids safe and successful. So, Dr. Kaur, thank you so much for sharing your information and time with us today. And, Janet, I'll turn it back over to you, if I may.
Thank you, Harold. Thank you so much, Dr. Kaur, for that really interesting conversation. For those of you who don't regularly attend this meeting, we're a committee, a community of learners. A lot of us are involved in the leadership of Hands and Voices, although there are other people who certainly join us. Typically, our committee consists of our own learning. Sorry, hang on just a second. Sorry, background noise. Anyway, so one thing we often do in our committee meetings when we're sharing with one another about what we're doing in our own world is we have a little mantra where we say, last month I did this towards our children's safety, and this month I will do whatever we're working on. I would like to encourage everybody on the phone today, as a result of this conversation, think about the world you're in right now, whether you're a part of an established early intervention program, a school, a parent support program. One of the very first activities we did as a group when we started our learning in this was to start to break the silence. In other words, to talk about this important issue. So I want to encourage you today, especially on this wonderful day of Valentine's Day, a day of love, thinking about all the children that we have the opportunity to intervene and provide protection and safety to. That if you're a part of a program that has not had a conversation or you're not sure what you're supposed to do, that think about this month that you will commit to just taking this information and sharing it with your colleagues and the work that you're doing in the programs that you're a part of. We learned a long time ago that if we were willing to just step out and to start having the conversation, even though it's difficult at times, we will begin to create a safety net for the lives of children who desperately need us to know what we're doing around this. Hands and Voices is passionately committed to the idea that everyone in our organization would have the basic understanding and information of knowing how to respond in any situation that they're involved in, if they have any questions or concerns, and even taking it to the next step of prevention and ensuring the safety and success of all our kids. I'd just like to publicly, again, thank Dr. Harold Johnson, who has really been our leader in this topic. And as he mentioned earlier on, it's a project that we've been a part of for over 10 years, and we feel in some ways we're just getting started. We're committed to this. If you go to handsandvoices.org, there's a front page section that will lead you to more information about this. So, again, Dr. Kaur, thank you so much for your presentation today. I just learned so much. It's been really good. And this year, our committee has been committed to just bringing in some new thoughts and expertise in this area for us to learn and grow in. So with that, I want to wish you all a very happy Valentine's Day. Think about the kids today in our world that we have the opportunity to provide safety and success for. And thank you all for joining us. We will be sending out the recording and the transcript from the captioning. If anyone's interested, they can, if you're on the committee list, you'll be getting that. If otherwise, you feel free to email janet@handsandvoices.org, and we'll make sure we get that to you. So thanks again. Any final comment, Harold?
No, just again, it's exciting the fact that, you know, we are continuing, and we know that unless we step forward, kids are not going to have the safety and success that they need. And so I just thank everyone for being on the committee. And again, please, if you would, share with us people that you know about, bright spots, people that we all can learn from. It'd be great if the people that we ask to speak to us as a group reflect even a broader sense of who are the experts out there, who are the bright spots. So please send any suggestions to Janet or myself, and we'll follow up with those. So we thank you all, and thank you, Janet, for your support.
Yep. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Janet, are you there?